but he was still my partner and my best friend. When Fran and I had a daughter, we named her Thomason Davis Franken. Then in 1985, Lorne came back to the show. He brought me and Tom back, along with a few other Lorne Again writers. Lorne asked the two of us to produce a show, and we jumped at the opportunity. But Lorne, on a youth kick, hired a group of talented but very young cast members like the 20-year-old Robert Downey Jr. and the 17-year-old Anthony Michael Hall, who were not suited to the kinds of sketches SNL had done before. You know, sketches where cast members play adults. The reviews were scathing. Since 1976, year two of SNL, we had all lived with Saturday Night Dead reviews, but that season we deserved it. With Tom routinely disappearing and me presiding over endless rewrite sessions and trying to hold the show together, I felt overwhelmed. Meanwhile, at home, after more than a decade of happy marriage, Franny and I were having trouble. After our second child, Joe, was born, Franny fell into a postpartum depression, which she secretly medicated with alcohol. Something was wrong, but I didn't know what. After the disastrous 1985-86 season, Tom and I decided to leave the show again. We'd go back to doing our act and working on screenplays. But in September of 1986, Franny's drinking just became too much. She had been going through her own kind of hell, trying as hard as she could to both be a good mother and keep her drinking problem a secret, and thank God she went to rehab. Taking care of a 5-year-old Thomason and an almost 2-year-old Joe, I needed a steady job in New York, so I asked Lorne if I could come back to the show, and he, of course, said yes. After getting Thomason off to school and Joe off to daycare, I'd arrive at 30 Rock about 10 hours before the other writers, with the exception of Bonnie and Terry Turner, a husband and wife team from Atlanta who had a daughter Thomason's age. Tom had decided to take a break from the show, so when he'd find time, we'd get together to work on our screenplay. I'd write during the day, pick the kids up, make them dinner, tuck them into bed, and leaving them with a sitter, go back to SNL. That's when I started going to Al-Anon, a 12-step program for family members and friends of alcoholics based on the principles of AA. Like AA, Al-Anon isn't for everybody, but once I started, it didn't take long for me to realize a few important things. For one thing, I finally realized that Franny wasn't the only addict in my life. My best friend since high school and writing partner for nearly 20 years was addicted to alcohol, to cocaine, to pretty much anything that came his way. But I also realized something about myself, that my reaction to Franny's and Tom's addictive behavior had made me a much less pleasant person to be around. As in AA, the fourth step in Al-Anon is to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself. The fifth step is to admit to God, or your concept of God, to yourself and to another human being the exact nature of your wrongs. That's to another human being and not to everyone who listens to this book. But I will say that I had developed a tendency to lose my temper, be judgmental, and roll my eyes when I thought someone said something stupid. In other words, at times I could be a bit of a jerk. I also discovered how much I could learn from listening to other people's stories, even people who at first blush didn't seem like the kind of people you could learn much of anything from. Thus, the birth of Stuart Smalley, the healing nurturer and member of several 12-step programs who hosted daily affirmations on SNL. Stuart became my most popular character on the show. Guess who hated Stuart? Tom. We still wrote together, sometimes, but he was becoming less and less of a presence on the show. One late Friday night, Tom came into the office and strolled past the big rewrite table where Jim Downey and I and a couple of other writers were trying to come up with a cold opening for the next night's show. "What are you working on?" asked Tom. Downey said, "Saturday Night Live." By 1991, Tom and I were still Frank and Davis, at least in theory, but while Franny was doing great in recovery, Tom was screwing up and in big trouble, so I organized an intervention. In an intervention, you usually present the alcoholic addict with some consequences if he/she refuses to go for treatment. It was hard to do. Tom had been my best friend since high school. I named my daughter after him. And despite the tension between us, I still thought he was the funniest guy I knew. Certainly in my mind, the funnier half of Franken and Davis. But I told him during the intervention that if he didn't go to rehab, we'd no longer be a team. It didn't work. It was a sad day. It was the end of our partnership and, at least for a few years, our friendship. And as is the case so often with addiction, things got weird. After the intervention, Tom found a guy who threatened to sue me if I didn't split the income I'd made from projects I'd done without him. I tried to reason with Tom, but he refused even to speak with me. But Tom and I had forgotten that, well before the intervention, we had agreed to be alumni of the year for Blake. For a host of reasons, it was something we couldn't not do. So Tom and I found ourselves at our old campus, arguing in the wings of the auditorium about the threatened lawsuit as Mr. Fecht explained to the K-6 graders, Al and Tom were two boys who went to school here, and they had a dream. That dream was to be on TV, and they worked very, very hard, and the dream came true. Addiction can take an unimaginable toll on the people who love addicts. And that's true even when the addicts in question find recovery. When Franny came back from rehab, things were still difficult. It turned out that early recovery can be hard on everyone. That experience became the basis for the 1994 movie When a Man Loves a Woman, which I wrote with my friend and Oscar winner Ron Bass. The movie, which starred Andy Garcia and Meg Ryan, has a happy and, I like to think, moving ending. And, of course, Franny and I had a happy ending, too. We're still married. We never argue about anything ever. And the higher power removed all my character defects, making me the most well-adjusted senator in the history of the body. Oh, and the movie made money for the studio. Ron and I each got a fruit basket after the opening weekend. The next summer, I shot a Stuart Smalley movie that I had written and was starring in, with Harold Ramis directing. Harold, who died in 2014, had been a friend since 1974 and was one of the comedy giants of our generation. Stuart Saves His Family, however, was by far Harold's least successful film, dying a terrible death at the box office. No fruit basket. In the end, Tom never actually sued me. We reconciled a few years later, and he asked me to be the best man at his wedding. We remained extremely close, reuniting for special performances and for frequent appearances on my radio show and sharing our devotion to the Grateful Dead and the inevitable disappointments from our beloved Minnesota Vikings. In 2009, Tom was diagnosed with cancer and given 6 months to a year. He lived 3 years with courage, grace, and humor, a gift to me and all who knew and loved him. I visited Tom a few days before he died at the house we once shared in upstate New York. Dan Aykroyd and his wife Donna came that day as well, and we laughed about how Tom had lain behind the counter during the Julia Child sketch, controlling the pressure on the spurting blood by working an insecticide sprayer that sent the dark red liquid through plastic tubing that ran up Danny's leg, through his sleeve, ending at his wrist. It was a special effect which technically is supposed to be performed by a union guy on the crew, but the crew loved Tom, and besides, he knew the bit, and he and Danny worked it to perfection live on air. Tom's humor was always sardonic. As you can imagine, it was even more sardonic that day. He was ready to go. The last few months hadn't been a lot of fun. But he told me he did enjoy crushing up the Dilaudid pills he'd been prescribed and snorting them. I told Tom that the way he was making his exit was an inspiration to me. He said, I hope you go a little faster. When Tom died, I called his mom, Jean, who recalled how much she loved hearing us laugh from their basement. A tremendous outpouring of love and affection for Tom flowed in from all over the country. It was wonderful to read people's memories of their favorite lines or sketches. Clearly, Tom had touched people's lives, or at least made them laugh. I spoke on the Senate floor about Tom a couple days later. I'm a crier, So I practiced the speech aloud about 40 times so I could make it through. I held it together until rest in peace. The next day, I was sitting in a Judiciary Committee hearing when a staffer slipped me a note. Leader Reed is on the phone for you. It was unusual for the majority leader to call me in the middle of a hearing. I got up, went to the ante room, and picked up the phone. Harry? Al, I read your eulogy to your friend. He was quite a guy. Yes, sir, he was. I love this part. The dark side of death. I smiled. Then Harry read a passage from a piece Tom had written about dying. In the foreseeable future, I will be a dead person. I want to remind you that dead people are people too. There are good dead people and bad dead people. Some of my best friends are dead people. Dead people have fought in every war. Then Harry said, it's perfect. Yes, I said, perfect. Chapter 5, Saturday Night Live, the part where I leave. Over the 15 years I spent at SNL, I worked on hundreds of sketches, many of them just big, dumb, silly stuff like Belushi as Elizabeth Taylor choking on a chicken bone. But the body of work I'm proudest of is the political satire that the show produced. It's important to emphasize that that work reflects the contributions of many writers and cast members. But more than anyone else, myself included, the credit for the sustained quality of SNL's political satire belongs to Jim Downey, the show's longtime head writer, producer, and occasional performer. Jim had a hand in virtually every SNL debate sketch during the nearly 35 seasons he spent at the show, including the genius strategery lockbox debate he wrote between George W. Bush and Al Gore, played brilliantly by Will Ferrell and Daryl Hammond, respectively. Bush never said strategery until Jim put it in Will's mouth. There's a good argument to be made that Jim's 2000 debate sketch was the most important piece of writing in that election cycle. Americans knew that Bush had trouble with the English language. Bush had made fun of that himself. But Jim caught a certain superciliousness with Daryl's Gore that Americans hadn't quite put their finger on. Jim and Daryl nailed it so specifically that anyone who watched the sketch couldn't help associate the real Gore with the fake Gore's repeated sighs and constant invoking of the Social Security lockbox. With that election decided by some 500 votes in Florida and a 5-4 Supreme Court decision, it's easy to argue that Jim Downey changed the course of history. I would say, tragically, I think Gore would have been a great president, may well have prevented 9/11, and would not have sent us to war in Iraq based on manufactured evidence. And he'd have addressed climate change, which to me is the greatest existential threat facing mankind. So thanks, Jim. During the George H.W. Bush administration, Jim and I wrote any number of cold openings, knowing that Dana Carvey's Nagada Bush could get laughs pretty much at will. Nagada, of course, meant I'm not going to do it, as in Nagada wouldn't be prudent. Jim and I would craft a piece that had a progression. This vial of crack was found in Lafayette Park, just across the street from the White House. This hypodermic needle was found on the White House lawn. And this bag of cocaine was found right here in the Oval Office, just 2 feet from my desk. It's bad. It's bad. It's getting bad. Dana could get so many laughs along the way with just his hands that the audience would sometimes lose the through line, and between dress rehearsal and air, Jim and I would actually have to tell him not to get so many laughs. Dana, of course, to his enormous credit, understood and delivered every time. Jim is an open-minded political conservative. I like to think I'm an open-minded liberal. We, like Lorne and everybody else on the show, felt it wasn't our job on SNL to have a political bias and advocate for one side or the other. That was fine for a show like Murphy Brown, a sitcom created by one person, Diane English, and starring Candace Bergen as a feminist TV journalist. SNL was a comedy variety show with many writers and performers, each with distinct views and voices. Sure, the preponderance of our cast and staff had your garden variety Hollywood liberal views, but we tried to do well-observed political satire that made the audience laugh and had the virtue of not being stupid. Jim's rule was to reward viewers for knowing stuff about politics without punishing them for not. So SNL wasn't the place to push my own personal political agenda. I saved that for my son's Little League practices. At the show, I was part of a team of dozens of writers and performers, and for our team, funny was the only thing that mattered. I did, however, start taking advantage of more and more opportunities to do political satire outside the show, where I could be a little more pointed about making fun of people who really deserved it. In the summer of 1992, I anchored a series of specials on Comedy Central, covering every night of both the Democratic National Convention in New York City and the Republican National Convention in Houston. We called the show Indecision 92. We broadcast out of a small studio in Lower Manhattan. Our pledge was that viewers of our coverage wouldn't miss anything that happened. To accomplish this, I sat at an anchor desk with a screen behind me, carrying the live feed from the convention floor that the network shared. Writer and humorist Roy Blunt Jr. sat nearby in a Barca lounger, watching four TVs tuned to the coverage on ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS. That way, if anything important or interesting happened, we could bring it to you within 10 seconds. For instance, if Dan Rather said, if a frog had side pockets, he'd carry a handgun, Roy would let us know right away. Modern political conventions tend to be tightly scripted, which is why the broadcast networks devoted only 2 hours a night to covering them. We did 4 hours a night, giving us plenty of time for commentary and comedy from a slate of special guests designed for political junkies. Norm Ornstein, Christopher Hitchens, Calvin Trillin, Ben Stein, Lawrence O'Donnell Jr., and Roger Ailes. Yes, Roger Ailes, who actually was very funny and who, as far as I know, did not sexually harass anyone during the 2 hours he was with us. Between the two conventions, my favorite letter came from a viewer who wrote, "The guy you had play Norm Ornstein was perfect." During the first night of the Republican National Convention in Houston, Ben Stein and I did commentary live during Pat Buchanan's religious war speech, the one that Molly Ivan said probably sounded better in the original German. Watching the speech, I made the comment that Buchanan's angry tone would hurt the Bush campaign, and of course it did, which traditional pundits wouldn't pick up on for weeks. In their 1992 year in review, Rolling Stone said it was disorienting to watch a comedy broadcast that almost incidentally told more truth and offered more insight than most networks and newspapers, and at the same time was so much more comfortable to watch. Today, of course, the idea of comedy that tells the truth in a way that serious political analysis misses isn't strange. Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert became not just successful comedians, but respected political figures because night after night, year after year, they offered more truth and insight than most real TV news. But they didn't invent meaningful political satire. They just brought it to a level of unprecedented popularity and influence. Before The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, there was Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher. And before Politically Incorrect, there was Indecision 92. And before that, there was something Jonathan Swift wrote about the potato famine. After the 8 nights of coverage of the conventions, we added a 9th show on election night, 1992. The evening began with a balloon drop as we called the election for Bill Clinton several hours before the networks did, based on exit poll data we had obtained from sources inside one of the networks, Norm Ornstein. By disregarding the notorious unreliability of exit polling, Comedy Central became the first source to break the news that Bill Clinton had been elected the 42nd president of the United States. And I'm afraid that maybe I was just a little too visibly happy about it. You see, in 1994, I was vying for a job that I had wanted for years at SNL, anchoring Weekend Update. But because I'd been wearing my bleeding liberal heart on my sleeve more and more, it was next to impossible for me to be an unbiased voice on the show's signature segment commenting on the week's news. That year, I headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which Beltway nerds nerdily referred to as the Nerd Prom, because it allows the Washington elite to mingle with the significantly more attractive Hollywood elite. Shortly after my performance, I was in Lorne's office with Steve Martin and Lorne. "Al, I saw that White House Correspondents' Dinner," Steve said, grinning. "You were great. That's what you should do." When Lorne didn't say, "Well, Steve, that's exactly what Al's going to be doing as the new anchor of Weekend Update," I kind of knew where things were headed. Lorne and Don Ohlmeyer, then head of NBC, went with Norm Macdonald, who in retrospect was a much better choice. Losing out on Update was a big part of the reason I decided it was time to move on after 15 seasons at SNL. It was a difficult decision. I loved the show. Lorne had created a safe haven for writers and performers, and there was nothing quite like writing something on a Tuesday night and seeing it kill on Saturday. But as we learn in Ecclesiastes, there is a time for all things, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to leave the show, a time to stay much too long at the show. After the Correspondents' Dinner, the whip-smart Leslie Schnurr, who had edited the Stuart Smalley book that eventually turned into the Stuart Smalley movie, suggested I try my hand at a political book. The title came to me in a flash: Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. The title, you see, was an ironic comment on the loss of civility in our public discourse. Limbaugh, with an audience of 20 million listeners a week, had been the bombastic cheerleader for the Gingrich Revolution, which culminated in the 1994 midterm elections when Republicans took the majority in the House for the first time in 40 years. The distinctly anti-government Limbaugh-Gingrich agenda swept in a significant number of radical Republicans, and with them a partisan enmity that has just grown even worse over the past two decades. In addition to the nastiness, there seemed to be a new willingness to lie about basic facts. According to Limbaugh, there is no conclusive proof that nicotine is addictive, and there are more American Indians alive today than when Columbus landed in 1492. And if all the polar ice caps melted, sea level would not rise. Rush explained that if an ice cube melts in a glass of water, the water level remains the same. Unfortunately, Greenland is a landmass, not an ice cube. Leaving SNL seemed like a good opportunity to use my comedic chops to influence the national political conversation instead of using my political knowledge to inform the comedy on the show. In Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations, I not only focused on Limbaugh and Gingrich, but also took on the whole cast of characters from the whack job right, from elected officials to conservative activists to columnists and TV pundits. When I finished the book, I had the publisher send Rush a copy with a note saying, "Al thinks it would help sales if you mentioned the book on the show." Well, one thing Rush Limbaugh isn't is an idiot. He was, however, very fat. So he kept his mouth shut. Nevertheless, Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations shot to number one on the New York Times bestseller list and stayed there for 23 weeks. Even better was the reaction I was getting from readers. When I traveled around the country on the book tour, progressives would come up to me and say things like, "Thank you," or "It's about time somebody took these guys on," or "Thank you, it's about time somebody took these guys on." This was new. I'd always thought there was nothing better than hearing people laugh, but hearing people tell me that they were not only entertained, but also energized to go out and take these guys on themselves, well, that was thrilling. It felt good to land on my feet, and it made it a lot easier to laugh along with Norm on Weekend Update. Hey, I'm human. Chapter 6. Paul. After the success of the Rush book, I started getting gigs on the lucrative lecture circuit. Turns out there aren't many speakers who know a lot about politics and are also funny. Usually this meant being flown first class to Scottsdale or Palm Springs or Vail to speak to a corporate conference on real estate investment trusts or reinsurance or how to get kids in third world countries to drink more Sprite. But I also became a popular speaker on the significantly less lucrative, as in I didn't get paid, National Progressive Circuit. And my favorite Democrat to speak for was Paul Wellstone. My parents introduced me to Paul back in 1990 when he first ran for the Senate. By then, Dad had made the transition from Jacob Javits Republican to George McGovern Democrat. In 1990, Dad was 82 and part of a senior citizens theater troupe for Wellstone that toured nursing homes. I never saw their show, but Dad had Paget's disease, the softening of the bones, so I imagine the choreography was somewhat limited. Paul was a little guy, and he was a fighter. Like me, Paul was a high school wrestler. Unlike me, he was a very good high school wrestler, and at the University of North Carolina was the Atlantic Coast Conference champion at the 126-pound level in 1964, and was subsequently inducted into the College Wrestling Hall of Fame, located in Wrestlingville, USA, and very much worth a visit if you're in the area. Wellstone brought his wrestler's energy and intensity to his activism. While teaching political science at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota in the early 70s, he organized poor single parents to fight for a publicly funded daycare center, public housing, and free school lunches. Paul kept getting arrested for protesting the Vietnam War, for protesting farm foreclosures, for selling steroids to other wrestlers. Okay, of course, Paul never sold steroids to other wrestlers, but there's a rule in comedy called the Rule of Three, and he was only arrested twice. See, this is the kind of note you're not going to get in Condoleezza Rice's memoir. After he picketed with strikers at the Hormel meatpacking plant in Austin, Minnesota, Carleton College fired Paul. But after Carleton's students staged a protest, the college reinstated him and gave him tenure. Paul Wellstone remains the youngest tenured professor in the school's history. In 1990, Paul won a long-shot race against sitting Senator Rudy Boschwitz, even though Paul was outspent by a 7-1 margin. Boschwitz was the only incumbent U.S. senator to lose that year, in large part because Paul ran an energetic grassroots campaign. He even had a senior citizens troupe perform at nursing homes. As a senator, Paul fought for the poor and dispossessed, for homeless vets, for people suffering from mental illness. Politics, he would say, is not about power. Politics is not about money. Politics is not about winning for the sake of winning. Politics is about the improvement of people's lives. And that's what he tried to do every day he served in the United States Senate. The last time I campaigned for Paul Wellstone was at the University Club in St. Paul about 8 weeks before the 2002 midterm election. Paul was in the middle of a very tight, very bitter race with former St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman, who had been handpicked by the Bush team to run against him. As you may recall at the time, the White House was pushing Congress to grant President Bush authority to go to war against Iraq. On October 2, 2002, just a little over a month before the election, Paul Wellstone became the only incumbent senator up for re-election to come out against the war. At the time, with war fever running high and pretextual lies coming fast and furious, this was pretty close to political suicide. That day, Paul told friends in the Senate and in Minnesota that he understood the vote would probably cost him his seat. As it turns out, even though a majority of Minnesotans supported going to war in Iraq, they respected Paul's principled vote, and he moved ahead of Coleman in the polls. The people of Minnesota value a politician who believes what he says and says what he believes and votes that way. Paul never prevaricated, and Minnesotans always knew where Paul Wellstone stood. Minnesotans also knew Paul's heart. Many of them had a personal story about his warmth, his humility, or his wit, and how it had touched their lives on a level that had nothing to do with politics. Here's mine. That evening at the University Club, the last time I saw my friend, the first thing he said to me in the thick of a battle for his political life was, "How's your mom?" As it so happened, I had just come from her nursing home in Minneapolis, where in her room, Mom kept a photo of Paul signed by him to her, "Phoebe, keep fighting, Paul." "Well, there are good days and bad days," I told Paul, as he knew she was suffering from sporadic dementia. And today was a bad day. It was tough. I couldn't even have a conversation with her. Paul nodded, put his hand on my shoulder, and said, "You know, touch means so much." That was Paul. Touch means so much. 2 weeks after the vote on the war, Paul and his wife Sheila and their daughter Marcia died in an airplane crash in northern Minnesota along with three staffers, Tom Lapick, Mary McAvoy, and Will McLaughlin, and pilots Richard Connery and Michael Guess. I didn't realize it at the time, but Paul's death would end up being part of the story of how I became a senator, serving in the same seat he had held for 12 years. But while I certainly never would have run for the Senate if Paul hadn't died, I also don't think I would have run had I not known him in life. Paul's greatest contribution to the progressive cause wasn't what he accomplished in the Senate, although he accomplished a lot. It's the way he inspired others to take action and taught them to be effective and gave them the confidence to stand up and shout about what they believed in. The more time you spent around Paul, the more his energy and his passion and his courage affected you and made you think that you could make a difference too. And to this day, if you travel around Minnesota and meet people who work in progressive politics, you'll hear many of them explain that they do it because of Paul. Some of them were part of his campaign and never stopped working for change even after he was gone, as a way to keep their hero's memory alive. Some of them trained with Wellstone Action, the nonprofit that became one of Paul's legacies, teaching people how to organize for progress. And some are too young to have ever really known him, but they're still inspired by his courage and his energy, the way this happy warrior never forgot that politics is about the improvement of people's lives. I can't think of a better tribute to Paul's life than the fact that, more than a decade after his death, the passion he brought to politics is still alive. There are a lot of people who are more politically active than they ever thought they'd be because they love who Paul was and what he stood for and felt called to do their part to carry forward the fights he led. I'm one of them. Chapter 7, A 99% Improvement. In April 2003, I was scanning political stories on my laptop when I noticed the profile of Minnesota Senator Norm Coleman in Roll Call, one of the Capitol Hill dailies. It was the first profile of Coleman, who had been in office just a little over 3 months. According to Roll Call, Norm had already become, quote, an emerging star on the GOP's rubber chicken circuit. I read on. "Most of it is because of beating Mondale," said Coleman, as he gesticulated his points with an unlit cigar in his new Hart office. Huh. As someone who had only ever gesticulated with an unlit cigar to make fun of people who gesticulate with unlit cigars, I got the impression that maybe Norm's ascent to the world's greatest deliberative body had gone to his head a bit. Then I read the sentence that would change my life. "To be very blunt, and God watch over Paul's soul, I am a 99% improvement over Paul Wellstone. I am a 99% improvement over Paul Wellstone." I'm sorry, but you don't say that about anyone who died within the last 6 months. And my God, you don't say it about a guy who everyone agreed was a compassionate, tireless champion of the little guy, a loving husband and father, and a colleague whom every senator recognized for his passion and decency. Until that exact moment, I had never, ever considered running for political office. But when I read that quote on the Roll Call website, my immediate thought was, somebody's got to beat this guy. Except I didn't think exactly that. Instead of guy, I thought jerk. Except I didn't think that either. It was something else. I can't say it on this audio. But it's not as bad as you might think. Okay, it was bastard. No, it wasn't, but it was worse than that. Fine, it was dingus. Somebody's got to beat this dingus. That's what I thought. Now, that's a really bad reason to run for office, and over time it would become less and less about beating Norm Coleman and more about the people of Minnesota. By the time I clobbered him on Election Day, in the narrowest clobbering in political history, I had almost forgotten that the germ of the idea to run had come from such a petty place. And anyway, at the time, I didn't think that the somebody who was going to beat this guy would end up being me. True, for a brief moment, I did find myself considering the fact that Franny and I were about to be empty nesters. Our son Joe was about to head off to college next year. It would be easy for us to move back to Minnesota and explore the idea. Then again, being an empty nester is not a good reason to run for the Senate either. It is, however, a great reason to take up a new hobby, such as gardening or paddle tennis, which can help ward off depression. In any event, I quickly set the thought aside. After all, I remind myself, first I have to finish this book, and then I've committed to doing a 3-hour radio show 5 days a week. How's that for exposition? See, I was reading the article while sitting in my office at the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, where I was a fellow. When I accepted the position, I thought I was going to be a teaching fellow, but I wasn't. I was just a fellow. They told me, however, that I could lead a study group on any subject I wanted. I asked if it was okay if I taught students how to research a satirical book on politics. They said sure. As it turns out, a lot of professors at Harvard teach students how to research their books. The book, which became Lies and Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, would argue that the right-wing media had created a right-wing echo chamber that often intimidates the mainstream media into reporting its distortions and outright lies. The centerpiece of the book would be a chapter detailing how the right had exploited the Wellstone Memorial, a long and boisterous event held shortly after his death and shortly before the 2002 election that reflected the deep passion that had animated Paul throughout his life, as well as the strong emotional connection so many people felt that they had had with him. Republicans had promptly seized the opportunity to paint the memorial as an inappropriately partisan event. The Coleman campaign and its allies lied about everything from the content of the eulogies to the audience's reactions, effectively hijacking Paul's memorial for their own selfish partisan purposes by falsely accusing Democrats of hijacking it for our own selfish partisan purposes. If you haven't read Lies, go find a bookstore near you, grab a copy off the shelf, and just read that chapter. Tell them Al sent you, and that I said it would be fine if you hung out in the aisle for half an hour reading without buying anything. Or, hell, get a coffee or an app or whatever it is they're selling to stay in business these days. I still feel strongly about this, and so do lots and lots of other Minnesota Democrats. Losing Paul was a crushing blow. Losing Paul and then watching Republicans lie about his memorial service for political purposes was adding a despicable insult to a still fresh injury, and watching their scheme succeed was dispiriting beyond words. To then see Norm Coleman immediately start bragging not just about how he ended Walter Mondale's political career, but about how he was a better senator than Paul because he was so loyal to the Bush administration, it was almost too much. That's why I had such a strong reaction to Coleman's 99% improvement line. And it's a part of the reason why, for me and for so many other Minnesota Democrats, my 2008 campaign would end up feeling like it was about more than just a Senate seat. As emotional and difficult as that Wellstone chapter was, the rest of the book was just fun. Team Franken did a lot of fact-checking on well-known conservatives like Ann Coulter, Dick Cheney, and Bill O'Reilly, who up until then had merely been suspected of being congenital liars. The book put to rest forever any doubt that they and many other prominent right-wingers were very much indeed lying liars. But even before the book came out, something interesting happened. Bill O'Reilly and Fox News sued me. It was really just a simple misunderstanding. O'Reilly and the Fox legal team apparently didn't understand that in America, satire is protected by the First Amendment, even if the object of the satire doesn't get it. In any event, Fox was literally laughed out of court. Literally, the New York Times headline read, "In courtroom, laughter at Fox and a victory for Al Franken." Aided by the free publicity generated by O'Reilly, Lies skyrocketed to the top of the bestseller list for months, selling over 1 million copies. Arianna Huffington told me, It's as if Bill O'Reilly walked up to you and handed you a check for $1 million. Readers responded to my thesis that the right's complaints about a liberal media bias in the mainstream media was disingenuous right-wing fiddle-faddle. They also liked the way I took on Bush's policies and his poppycock claims like, the vast majority of my tax cuts goes to those at the bottom. On the book tour that fall, once again, I kept hearing things like, finally, someone's taking it to these guys. It felt good, even when they were visibly intoxicated. And every so often, someone would come up to me and say, why don't you run for office? Especially Minnesota, where people were already thinking ahead to 2008, when Norm Coleman would have to run for re-election. But I had other things on my mind. While researching lies, I learned that 22% of Americans were getting their news from talk radio, which meant right-wing talk radio. Liberals had ceded the airways to Rush Limbaugh and the Rush Limbaugh wannabes, and also in those days, the band Linkin Park, which was getting a lot of airplay. But in March 2003, while I was still researching and writing the book, I had taken the plunge and committed to hosting a daily 3-hour progressive radio show. I quickly learned a few things about radio. Radio stations have formats. Classic rock is a format. Country is a format. Hot adult contemporary, whatever that means, is a format. Talk radio is not a format. Conservative talk is a format. Placing my show between Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity or between Mark Levin and Michael Savage would have been like putting 3 hours of hip-hop on a station that otherwise carried a day of its polar opposite, hop-hip. So we had to invent a new format, progressive radio, and that meant creating an entire day of programming, and while we were at it, an entire national radio network called Air America. The concept for my show was simple. We would not try to be the mirror image of right-wing radio, but its opposite. My executive producer, Billy Kimball, put together a staff of researchers, writers, and producers. Catherine Lanfer, a seasoned journalist and a fixture at Minnesota Public Radio, came aboard as my co-host. And on March 31st, 2004, the Al Franken Show, then called the O'Franken Factor, in an effort to further irritate Bill O'Reilly, went live. This is Al Franken speaking to you from 30,000 feet under Dick Cheney's bunker, and this is Air America Radio. We have watched the right wing take over the Congress, White House, and courts, and as insidiously the airways. We need a great watchdog to track them, and until one comes along, I'll have to do. We laid down some basic rules right off the bat. No call-ins, no actors talking about politics. We call that the Tim Robbins rule. And while we did some stuff that was just funny for the sake of being funny, like when I played Strom Thurmond bragging about his sexual conquest, Catherine, I screwed them all. Yes, you did. I screwed them all. Or when my old partner Tom Davis would come on as the CEO of a sketchy outfit called Accountants Without Borders. I also wanted ours to be a show that was serious about public policy. After all, as long as I would be committing to preparing for and doing a daily 3-hour show, I might as well learn something. So we decided that our guests would be people who knew stuff. For example, you often hear people say that Elizabeth Warren was talking about income inequality before almost anybody else. Well, one of the places she was talking about it before almost anybody else was on our show. We'd have her on to discuss the 2005 bankruptcy bill, an outrageous handout to the credit card industry, conservative attacks on pensions and Social Security, and the general deterioration of the middle class. But the thing we talked about more than anything else was Iraq. Lies and the Lying Liars was already on the bookshelves by the time it became clear that Bush's administration's biggest lie wasn't about tax cuts. There is no doubt, Dick Cheney had declared in the lead-up to the invasion, that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt he's amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us. Cheney was lying. And it's still crazy to think that he and the president and so many others, including, for God's sakes, Colin Powell, just flat out lied us into a war. Heck, I was in the process of finishing a scholarly masterwork about how they lied all the time, and even I didn't think they would lie us into a war. But by the end of 2003, it was obvious that anyone who had maintained even the barest shred of faith in the administration's integrity and basic decency had made a mistake. There were no weapons of mass destruction. Worse, it turned out that Bush et al. Hadn't just lied us into a war, they lied us into a disaster. That Christmas, I went to Iraq for the first time on a USO tour. USO tours are the best thing I've ever done. I've done 7 now, 4 of them to Kuwait, Iraq, and Afghanistan. I would spend about 2 weeks doing shows with an eclectic group of entertainers, including NFL cheerleaders and extremely right-wing country stars like Daryl Worley. Franny knew I loved these tours, but one year she said to me in frustration, "You don't see Bill O'Reilly going on USO tours." "That's not fair, honey," I said. "He has no talent." Between shows, we'd hit the DFACS, dining facilities, 3, 4, 5 times a day. Walking with your tray, looking for a place to sit down, you could see who wanted to talk. I learned a tremendous amount on these USO tours. Later, as a senator, I'd go on to visit Afghanistan on a CODEL, where we'd meet with top officials, most of whom would tell us exactly what they were supposed to tell us. Traveling with the USO, you could learn a lot more from the privates, lieutenants, command sergeant majors, and one stars shooting the breeze in the DFACS in between shows. Everyone had different points of view. Back then, truck drivers were beginning to get blasted with IEDs. Guys fighting outside the wire were a lot more on edge than guys inside the wire. In my first Middle East tour in 03, while we were on our first stop in Kuwait, troops found Saddam Hussein in a spider hole near his hometown in Tikrit. But even in the flush of capturing Saddam, the message we got was that Operation Iraqi Freedom was not going quite as planned. Adding to the costs, both in blood and treasure, was the waste, fraud, and abuse by military contractors during Iraq's reconstruction. Billions were being ripped off by shady contractors. Work was not completed, or on some projects never started. And the inability to replace the loss of key infrastructures, roads, electricity, water, and sewage, sent the country spiraling further into chaos. Everyone in Iraq was paying the price. So were American taxpayers, and so were our troops, often with their lives. Oh, and by the way, guess who was officially in charge of exposing and reining in waste, fraud, and abuse in Iraq? It's someone you may remember from earlier in this chapter. No, not Catherine Lanfer. It was Norm Coleman. The newly elected Coleman had been given the plum chairmanship of the hallowed Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, known as PSI. The chairman of PSI is the only United States senator with sole subpoena power. He can investigate anything he wants. Originally, PSI had been the Truman Committee, in the lead-up to and during World War II. Before the war, Harry Truman, then a senator from Missouri, personally drove around the country in his car to inspect training camps and found widespread mismanagement and downright theft. Because the committee saved millions and so strengthened our war effort, Truman made the cover of Time, and in 1944, FDR chose him as his running mate. Truman's committee did 432 separate hearings on waste, fraud, and abuse in war contracting. While Coleman was chairman of PSI, his committee did exactly 432 fewer hearings than Truman's on waste, fraud, and abuse in war contracting. I went back to Iraq with the USO each of the next 3 winters, and every time I went, it seemed like things were getting worse. And even on that first visit, it was clear that some basic problems were not being taken care of. In Kuwait, they divided us up to go to different bases around Iraq. I volunteered to go to Tikrit, Saddam's hometown, and they thought a potentially dangerous place to go. As we boarded our plane in Kuwait, a soldier took me aside and suggested that I should make sure I got a flak jacket equipped with modern Kevlar plates. The Vietnam-era flak jacket I was wearing, he said, wouldn't really stop a bullet. So when I got to Iraq, I should insist on upgrading to Kevlar. He emphasized the word insist. I nodded. Insist, I got it. When our plane landed in Baghdad, we were transferred quickly to a waiting helicopter for the flight to Tikrit. As I climbed in, I turned to an airman and said, I've been told to ask for Kevlar plates for my flak jacket. The airman said, we don't have any. Uh-huh, I said, but I was told to insist. Well, that's fine, but we just don't have them. There was an uncomfortable moment before I tried one last time. Okay, I'm insisting. I understand we don't have any. So off I went to Tikrit, supposedly the most dangerous place in Iraq, where fortunately I was not shot, and neither were the cheerleaders. This failure to properly equip and protect our troops would become an ongoing scandal. Right before I went on my third trip in 2005, it came out that troops in Kuwait were going to dumps in search of metal they could use to up-armor their own Humvees. In response to the outcry, Donald Rumsfeld famously said, "You go to war with the army you have, not the army you want." This was particularly galling since the date he said this was further from 9/11 than VJ Day was from Pearl Harbor. In preparation for that year's USO tour, I asked SNL to make a flak jacket out of a garbage can and wore it during my opening monologue at our show, saying, "We've got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is there aren't any cheerleaders this year. The good news is," pointing to my garbage can flak jacket, "I've got 100 more of these." The radio show had started with an explicit goal of defeating President Bush in his 2004 re-election campaign. We all worked really hard to take down a guy whom we already were pretty sure was one of the worst presidents in history, and we failed. So 2005 was a pretty dark time for progressives. Just as in 2016, a Republican had won a presidential election, despite things that to many of us seemed obviously disqualifying. In Bush's case, it was Iraq and not his entire life story and personality. And now conservatives had a lock on all three branches of the government, plus a lie-amplifying propaganda machine. But the political infrastructure we'd started to build during the campaign, David Brock's media watchdog group, Media Matters, the Center for American Progress think tank, and even Air America itself, was working to help the progressive movement regroup, get re-energized, and find a new direction. Right after he got re-elected, President Bush promised to privatize Social Security. We stopped him. And despite Karl Rove's predictions of a, quote, permanent Republican majority, we were slowly figuring out how to fight back. We were getting better at debunking Fox News and learning how to counter the kind of smear campaign that Republicans had run to perfection in 2004, as well as generating powerful ideas of our own. When I first started writing about politics, I just wanted to prove that the right-wing figures who got under my skin were liars and frauds. I was in what I now think of as the get-it-off-my-chest phase of my political development. But now it felt like I was part of something bigger, a real movement to change the direction of the country. By the summer of 2005, I was working on the follow-up to Lies and Lying Liars, The Truth with Jokes. Except this time, instead of just making fun of the Bush administration's mouthpieces, I found myself focusing more on making the case against the Bush administration itself and its terrible policies. The last chapter of The Truth, a letter to my grandchildren named Hillary Brock and Joe III, flashed forward 10 years to October 2015. And I told what I hoped would be the story of the intervening decade, one in which Democrats would take back Congress in the 2006 midterms, changing the political landscape by offering a slew of great ideas and setting the stage for a Democratic president to be elected in 2008. Then we would pass all sorts of legislation, beginning with universal health care and an Apollo project for renewable energy, and continuing on to tackle tax fairness, public education, and increasing youth turnout by legalizing voting by AOL Instant Messenger, which I am told nobody uses anymore. Oh, and in this scenario, I would be elected to the Senate in 2008. I hadn't forgotten about the whole 99% improvement thing. And as a rock fell apart, Norm Coleman's failure to perform his oversight responsibilities was only making me more sure that somebody indeed had to beat this guy. But by now I was beginning to think that maybe, just maybe, that somebody should be me after all. Chapter 8, Year of the Bean Feed. In late 2005, I told a friend that I was very seriously considering running for the Senate. "Why would you do that?" he asked incredulously. "Well," I said, "I think I could accomplish a lot, and what do I really have to risk?" My friend looked dubious. Public opprobrium? The truth is, no one debating whether or not to run for office is worried about the upside. The problem is the downside. Sure, as an empty nester who had already had a successful career, I was playing with house money. But while the stuff in the pro column was pretty compelling, I was confident I could do a lot of good. It would feel great to beat Coleman, and also, like a lot of people, I kind of really wanted to be a senator. There were a lot of what Donald Rumsfeld charmingly referred to as known unknowns. For example, would I be a good candidate? Did I know enough about the issues? Could I deal with the long hours and the tough questions and the personal attacks and the groveling for money? What if I sucked at it? What if I hated it? What if the voters hated me? What if I lost a race that someone else could have won? What if I was humiliated? What if I had to give a concession speech where I graciously congratulated Norm Coleman on his victory? And what was opprobrium anyway? Most of all was the risk of things going wrong worth the potential good I could do and fun I could have if things went right. There were a lot of questions, and I didn't know the answers, but I told Franny, I don't want not to do the things I'll want to have done if I decide to run. What? Replied Franny. Never mind. You know how we've been talking about moving back to Minnesota and maybe running for the Senate? Yeah. Let's do it. Oh, okay. Sure, if that's what you want to do, honey. As in most marriages, my wife and I have a division of labor when it comes to the day-to-day operations of our household. Basically, it's this. Franny's in charge. I had a vision. I wanted to buy a house near where I grew up in the western suburbs of Minneapolis. Something a little bigger, of course, with a nice big yard. Franny said no, absolutely not. She told me that a house requires constant upkeep and that she'd end up having to do it because I'd be doing the radio show and going all around the state of Minnesota while she had to deal with every plumbing problem or beetle infestation. So instead of a big house with a big yard and bad plumbing and a beetle problem, Franny found us a townhouse very near downtown Minneapolis. Less upkeep, less hassle, and best of all, I could walk to work. We broadcast a show from atop the historic Fauché Tower, which, when I was a boy, was the city's tallest building, smugly thrusting its antenna into the innocent Minneapolis sky. But modern skyscrapers now tower above the once-proud Fauché, which cowers meekly among the indifferent glass and steel. I've submitted this paragraph to a middle school writing contest. In my free time, I started laying the foundation for a potential campaign. That meant learning as much as I could about Minnesota issues and getting as much advice as I could from key political players. And it meant showing up everywhere I could to rally DFLers. That means Democratic Farmer Labor Party members, DFLers. That's the Democratic Party in Minnesota, the DFL. So I could rally DFLers across the state for the critical 2006 midterm elections, a sort of dry run for what my own campaign might be like. I also set up a political action committee, a PAC, which would allow me to meet big-shot donors, gauge my fundraising appeal, and build some goodwill by supporting deserving candidates in Minnesota and around the country. Setting up a PAC is a lot easier than it might sound. Basically, you just appoint a treasurer. I pick my high school buddy, Tom Borman. Fill out a four-page form available on the Federal Election Commission's website, and voila, you have a PAC. I named mine Midwest Values PAC, drawn to the clever acronym MVP. Unfortunately, MVP.com already directed to the online store for CBS Sports. Bastards. I thought about just giving up on the whole Senate thing, but no. We would overcome this first hurdle and just buy MidwestValuesPack.org. Not as good, but as I would learn, politics is the art of the possible. Things got easier, mostly because I hired some people who knew what they were doing. Dinah Dale, a soft-spoken Arkansan who had overseen Paul Wellstone's fundraising operation, was in charge of connecting me with wealthy progressives who might be interested in contributing to my PAC. Dinah brought in another Wellstone alum, A.J. Goodman.